From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
They have to stop it. These are violations of humanitarian law, and the civilians should be shielded. Civilians are protected people. They are not the targets.
As the number of Lebanese refugees reaches 900,000, the U.S. has refused to join international calls for a ceasefire. We'll speak with independent journalist Dar Jamal, who's just traveled from Syria to Beirut. Then we'll go to Baghdad and talk to reporter Barzu Daraghi.
The situation in Iraq appears to have really deteriorated in the last few weeks. One massive car bomb, and then a few hours later, you'll have 20 dead bodies showing up, you know, each from different groups. So there's a real rhythm to the attack and the violence.
And we'll continue our conversation with Yonatan Shapira, the former Israeli Black Hawk pilot, who's encouraging other Israeli soldiers to refuse to fight.
I understood that by refusing to participate in these attacks, these illegal and immoral attacks, I will contribute more to the security of my country.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Nearly 400 people have now died in Lebanon since Israel began attacking the country 13 days ago. Over 1,000 have been wounded, and as many as 900,000 have been displaced from their homes. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice arrived in Beirut today and is scheduled to go to Israel. The Bush administration is still refusing to back an immediate ceasefire. On Friday, Rice described the plight of Lebanon as part of the, quote, birth pangs of a new Middle East. The United States, however, is helping to restock Israel's military arsenal. The New York Times reports the Bush administration has agreed to send a rush delivery of satellite and laser-guided bombs to Israel. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz says Israeli officials believe they have approval from the United States to keep attacking Lebanon for at least another week. However, Britain has broken ranks with Washington. Britain's Foreign Office Minister Kim Howells publicly criticized Israel's military tactics and urged the United States to understand the price being paid by ordinary Lebanese civilians. Meanwhile, Syria and Saudi Arabia have offered to help secure peace plans. On Sunday, the United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator Jan Egeland toured Beirut and condemned Israel's actions as violations of humanitarian law.
What I see is a disproportionate response, in my view. Whole blocks being leveled to the ground, virtually, in southern Beirut, mostly residential houses, as I could see it. We were trampling on school books when we went through the rubble. But of course, Hezbollah blending into the population and continuing to send missiles, rockets into Israel. They have to stop it. These are violations of humanitarian law, and the civilians should be shielded. Civilians are protected people. They are not the targets.
Reports out of Lebanon indicate Israel's widening its assault on Lebanon. Israeli ground troops have seized the Lebanese hilltop town of Marouna Ras. Heavy fighting was reported this morning between Israeli troops and Hezbollah fighters. Over the weekend, Israeli warplanes knocked down telecommunications towers handling much of Lebanon's cell phone, television, and radio communications. A technician working for the Lebanese Broadcasting Corporation was killed. In a separate attack, a 23-year-old photojournalist named Layal Najib was killed by an Israeli missile. She worked for the Lebanese magazine Al Jaras and Agence France-Presse. Refugees fleeing southern Lebanon have repeatedly come under attack. On Sunday, an Israeli helicopter fired at a minivan carrying 16 civilians. Three people died. All the passengers were fleeing the village of Tyre, which Israeli forces had ordered residents to evacuate. Reuters is reporting six Lebanese Red Cross paramedics were wounded late Sunday when Israeli warplanes hit their vehicles. Also Sunday, Israel bombed the southern port city of Sidon for the first time. Thousands of refugees had been seeking shelter there. Early this morning, the Israeli military shelled a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon. One local hospital in the southern city of Tyre received 41 wounded patients on Sunday. All of the casualties are believed to be civilians who were attacked while trying to seek safety. The hospital's director said this is the worst day we've seen. The death toll in Tyre has been so high that carpenters are reportedly running out of wood for coffins. Bodies are stacked three or four high in a truck at the hospital morgue. Peter Buchart of Human Rights Watch said, quote, "They've been hitting civilian cars all over the place. I've been in many war zones, but this is one of the most dangerous places I've seen." Inside, a top city official, Abdulrahman al-Basri, said the area urgently needs assistance.
But we are not receiving any help at all from the international committee and the international community. International NGOs have just appeared now in town. They are still assessing the situation, but I'm afraid that their response will be too little, too late.
Sidon city official Abdulrahman al-Basri speaking yesterday. The United Nations Refugee Agency announced Sunday that tons of humanitarian aid material have been stuck in Syria because there's no safe route to reach people driven from their homes. 80% of Lebanon's highways and 95% of bridges have been damaged. International protests against the Israeli war in Lebanon continued over the weekend, including in Israel. More than 2,500 rallied Saturday in Tel Aviv. Meanwhile, the Israeli press has reported Israel's begun building new detention centers to jail anyone captured in Lebanon. Israel's already imprisoning about 11,000 Palestinians. On Sunday, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said that the current Israeli offensive against the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah would, quote, last a very long time. Over the weekend, Hezbollah continued to fire rockets into northern Israel. Two residents of Haifa were killed in a rocket attack Sunday. So far, Hezbollah has killed 17 Israeli civilians. About 20 Israeli soldiers have also died fighting in Lebanon. Dan Gillerman, Israel's ambassador to the United States, said Hezbollah must be destroyed.
This cancer must be excised. It cannot be partially removed or allowed to fester. It must be removed without any trace, or, as cancers do and will, it will return and spread, striking and killing again.
Israel's ambassador to the United Nations. Israel suggested it may back a plan for international troops to patrol southern Lebanon. Meanwhile, the San Francisco Chronicle is reporting Israel's attack on Lebanon is based on well-developed plans. More than a year ago, a senior Israeli army officer began giving PowerPoint presentations on an off-the-record basis to diplomats, journalists, and think tanks, setting out the plan for the current operation in revealing detail. In his talks, the officer described a three-week campaign which involved ground troops being sent in during the third week. In Gaza, Israeli warplanes bombed a series of buildings overnight suspected of being used by Palestinian militants. Over the past 3 weeks, about 115 Palestinians have been killed. A majority of them have been civilian. Meanwhile, in other news from Israel, doctors say the condition of former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has worsened. He's been in a coma for 6 months. In Iraq, a series of car bombs killed about 60 people Sunday. 36 civilians died in marketplace bombings in Sadr City. Another 20 civilians died in the northern city of Kirkuk after a car bomb exploded outside a courthouse. Saturday was also a bloody day in Baghdad. Two American soldiers were killed, seven Shiite construction workers were gunned down, and five Sunni civilians were blown up. The bombings came as Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki was preparing to travel to London and Washington to meet with Tony Blair and President Bush. In London, al-Maliki condemned Israel's destruction of Lebanon's infrastructure and vowed to push for a ceasefire. British reporter Patrick Coburn says Iraqis are terrified in a way that he's never seen over the past three decades. The United Nations estimates 6,000 civilians were killed in Iraq in May and June, but Coburn says the violence has been far worse during the past month. Meanwhile, Iraq's parliament speaker, Mahmoud Mashadani, accused U.S. forces in Iraq of butchery. At a U.N.-sponsored conference on reconciliation, Mashadani said, quote, "Just get your hands off Iraq and the Iraqi people and Muslim countries and everything will be all right." He went on to say, quote, "What has been done in Iraq is a kind of butchery of the Iraqi people." Mashadani also criticized U.S. support for the Israeli attacks against Lebanon. Here in the United States, four U.S. Army soldiers accused of murdering three Iraqis have said they did so under orders to, quote, kill all military age males. Lawyers for the soldiers say two senior officers, a colonel and a captain, have acknowledged they gave that order. The soldiers are accused of detaining three Iraqi men and then allowing them to be released before shooting them. One of the soldiers claims a sergeant was upset that the Iraqi men had been captured. The sergeant reportedly said, "Why did you take them prisoner? Why didn't you kill them?" Legal experts say an order to kill all military-age men would be clearly unlawful, and any officer giving it would be liable for any action taken. In other news from Iraq, ousted President Saddam Hussein was hospitalized over the weekend. He's been on a 17-day hunger strike to protest his trial. His lawyers say the U.S. military is now force-feeding him. Three of his seven co-defendants have joined him in refusing food. The largest lawyers group in the country is warning President Bush is undermining the Constitution by claiming he has the authority to ignore laws passed by Congress. A new report by the American Bar Association criticizes the president's use of what's known as signing statements. Since he took office, President Bush has issued over 750 signing statements, more than any president ever. ABA President Michael Greco said, quote, "We will be close to a constitutional crisis if this issue, the president's use of signing statements, is left unchecked." Bush has used signing statements to challenge laws, including a congressional ban on torture, a request for data on the USA Patriot Act whistleblower protections, and the banning of U.S. troops fighting in Colombia. In Mexico, 10 gunmen wearing ski masks attacked a student-run university in Oaxaca on Sunday. Shots were fired at the radio station, but no one was injured. The station has supported community protests against Oaxaca's state governor. Some accused the governor, Ulises Ruiz, of being behind the attack. Dozens of teachers, students, and activists are now guarding the radio station. Meanwhile, Cuban President Fidel Castro and Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez gathered with others this weekend in Argentina. Chavez and Castro made a pilgrimage to the childhood home of Che Guevara. A new report from Amnesty International says security agents in Jordan are torturing terrorism suspects on behalf of the United States in the hopes of forcing confessions. Amnesty investigators had identified about 10 suspected cases of men subjected to rendition from U.S. custody to interrogation centers in Jordan, a close U.S. ally in the Middle East. Amnesty described Jordan as a central hub in a global complex of secret detention centers operated by the United States. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from Israel's attack on Lebanon is approaching 400, almost all civilian. More than 1,000 have been wounded. An estimated 900,000 have been displaced from their homes. Reports indicate Israel is widening its assault. This weekend, ground troops seized the Lebanese town of Mourin al-Ras. Meanwhile, Israeli warplanes knocked down telecommunications towers handling cell phone, television, and radio broadcasts. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Israeli officials believe they've approval from the United States to keep attacking Lebanon for at least another week. However, Britain has broken ranks with Washington. In an interview with CNN, the British Foreign Minister Kim Howells criticized Israel's military tactics and urged the U.S. to understand the price being paid by ordinary Lebanese civilians. Meanwhile, the United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator Jan Egeland toured Beirut and condemned Israel's actions as violations of humanitarian law. We now turn to independent journalist Dar Jamal. He arrived in Beirut this weekend after spending the last week interviewing refugees on the Syria-Lebanon border. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dar Jamal.
Beirut, it's a very tense atmosphere here. The roar of Israeli warplanes is nearly constant at times down to the south, both in over southern Beirut and particularly over the southern part of the country. Earlier, I was standing on the balcony of my hotel, and the echoes of bombings from the south were rolling over Beirut like distant claps of thunder, followed by a roaring afterburn of warplanes, which had dropped the bombs. I would say, on average, about every half hour, there are very loud explosions from the south that we can hear very clearly here in Beirut. And, of course, the sentiment here, people are very anxious, very tense. The evacuation of foreign nationals continues from the port of Beirut. As I drove in, I saw at least half a dozen warships from different countries out in the blue water of the Mediterranean waiting to come pick up people from the port of Beirut and take them away. And this is being viewed by people here in Beirut with great anger. One man told me earlier in the Hamra district here in Beirut, he said, you know, this shows us very clearly how we're seen in Western eyes, that Lebanese just leave us here for the Israeli bombs, take the Westerners away. It's clear that we just have the wrong passport, so we don't matter. And that so far has been a quite widespread sentiment that I've seen while the bombing continues in the south. Also, I can report that in southern Lebanon today, the Sidon has been very, very heavily bombed. A mosque there was destroyed. There were already at least 42,000 refugees there. Also, a minibus carrying refugees was fleeing a southern city right on the border that was recently taken by Israeli forces, Maroun al-Ras. And that minibus carrying refugees was hit, killing three people and wounding another 13. So really, the crisis continues to escalate. There doesn't really seem to be much of a let up in the bombing. And right here in Beirut, it's very, very evident. And I'm waiting to see what happens tonight, because everyone I've spoke with said that night times are the worst time in Beirut, that it's quite widespread bombing. The Israelis are tending to wait until the middle of the night before they start bombing. So we're waiting for that to happen now. But without a doubt, public opinion is that of very, very much anger. People are extremely anxious. People are very concerned that once the last of these foreign nationals that are being evacuated from Beirut are gone, people here very much expect things to get much, much worse. So that is the mood. That, along with widespread anger. I spoke with one student earlier from the American University of Beirut, which is nearby my hotel, and he said that he is very much against Hezbollah and always has been and is more now than ever because of what this has caused his country. But he said he's very much opposed to this Israeli reaction to what happened. And he said, he told me that he very much hates the fact that the U.S. is supporting Israel 100% in everything that they do here now. And even though his dream was to go to the United States, as he's a business student at the university here, now he said that he hates the United States. And so it's very easy to say, not just after talking with this man, but several other people today as well, that the level of anti-American sentiment is really through the roof, because people are extremely, very acutely aware of the U.S. greenlighting this ongoing Israeli aggression against their country. Over the last week, I interviewed dozens of refugees on both the western border of Syria with Lebanon as well as the northern border of Lebanon with Syria. They were reporting atrocities. They were reporting war crimes carried out by the Israeli military in southern Lebanon and in southern Beirut, which is where naturally most of these refugees came from. There are hordes of these refugees. Right now, there's at least over 250,000 of them that have come into Syria thus far. And most of those that I spoke with were all saying the same thing, and that was that it was widespread indiscriminate bombing in villages. Cars full of people fleeing those villages were being attacked by warplanes as they tried to leave. One man told me of a hospital that he saw with his own eyes being bombed by warplanes in South Beirut. Another spoke of seeing an ambulance being targeted by airstrikes itself. It's really a catastrophic situation as far as the refugees go. People have left, many of them, literally with nothing but the clothes on their back and what they had in their pockets at the time. So they are really left with nothing and nowhere to go. And so there's a burgeoning crisis, not just within Lebanon, but it is, of course, spilling over into Syria at a very large level. In Damascus as well, I interviewed many people, and they were extremely angry at what was happening. I was at the Red Crescent headquarters in Damascus, and I interviewed a man from a village in South Lebanon, and I asked him how he felt about what was happening there, and he just stood up, and I almost felt he was going to attack me. He was so angry. He was defending Hezbollah to the end. He said that no matter what Israel does, this is going to backfire on them, and really come out so negatively for them as far as their security situation. And that has been a very common sentiment among really most of the refugees that I've interviewed, whether they be Lebanese or people who weren't necessarily very pro-Hezbollah, but also people who, of course, were from the South, who most of which were very pro-Hezbollah. It's that the overall sentiment is really a deep seething anger amongst the refugees towards what's going on in Lebanon.
Dar Jamal, independent journalist who spent last week on the Syria-Lebanon border and has just arrived in Beirut. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. The Beirut Fedouz here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our coverage of the latest in the Middle East and Iraq, the Pentagon has announced it'll be sending more troops into Baghdad. Violence in the Iraqi capital has only worsened since U.S. and Iraqi troops launched a massive security crackdown 6 weeks ago. More than 40 people were killed in bomb attacks in Baghdad Sunday. Another 22 died in a car bombing in Kirkuk. Baghdad's central morgue says it's received more than 1,000 bodies already this month. According to the U.S. military, bombings and shootings increased by more than 40% just last week. The violence is creating thousands of refugees by the day. The Iraqi government says more than 30,000 in just over 3 weeks. For the latest, we go now to Baghdad, and we're joined by Barzu Dahraghi. He is the Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Barzu.
Thank you.
Can you describe the latest just this past weekend?
Oh, I mean, it's just been a very rough time here in Baghdad and other parts of the country as well. The worst incident over the weekend was a really devastating car bomb in a busy produce market in the Shiite district of Sadr City. It killed over 37 people and injured dozens. And then up in Kirkuk, which is a kind of a different struggle there. You don't have the same sort of sectarian tensions between Shiites and Sunnis up there. You had a car bomb in Kirkuk that killed at least 21 people, injured 100, according to police officials up there. Kirkuk is the site of an ethnic conflict between ethnic Kurds, Arabs, and Turkmen. All vying for control of the oil-rich city.
There is most media coverage of what's going on right now in Lebanon. How would you compare this to the past in Iraq right now?
I mean, it's definitely intensifying. I think everyone acknowledges that in terms of the number of civilian casualties, in terms of the level of tension and fear on the streets, in terms of the quality of life for ordinary people, it's gotten much worse in recent weeks. You have a lot of fire sales at stores, people packing stuff up and selling it off in order to close their stores and move on. You definitely notice that with Iraqis. There's a real sense of dislocation on the part of many Iraqis. The ones who can afford to have already left the country, even just for a brief respite, maybe to Jordan. The ones who can't are trying to leave the country, even the people who barely afford it. Everyone you know is, sleeping at a friend's house or sleeping at a relative's house, trying to get away from trouble in their particular neighborhood. Many families have moved from their areas and moved to other areas where they feel more safe. So, you know, it's definitely palpable. It's definitely, you know, for Iraqis at least, it's definitely the worst I've ever seen it.
I wanted to ask you about the quote of the head of the parliament at a UN-sponsored conference on reconciliation. The parliament speaker, Mahmoud Mashidani, accused U.S. forces in Iraq of butchery. He said, just get your hands off Iraq and the Iraqi people and Muslim countries and everything will be all right. He went on to say what has been done in Iraq is a kind of butchery of the Iraqi people. He also criticized U.S. support for the Israeli attack on Lebanon. Your response?
Well, I think Mahmoud Mashidani is he's a charming fellow, and he makes a lot of really interesting remarks. I don't think his remarks are representative of the Iraqi government in general. I don't know if you could call what is happening here, and I disagree that you could call it like butchery on the part of Americans. I think there is butchery going on, but most of it is being, sadly, it's Iraqi on Iraqi butchery, with the U.S. Sometimes maybe more clumsily than anything contributing to that butchery. But not as a matter of policy, whereas many of the groups that are out here, such as the Shiite militiamen and the Sunni insurgents, they seem to have their methodology seems to be, killing other Iraqis.
I'm wondering how much attention some of the stories of atrocities that trickle into the United States of U.S. soldiers get in Iraq. The latest one, 4 U.S. Army soldiers accused of murdering 3 Iraqis have said they did so under orders to, quote, kill any military age males. Lawyers for the soldiers say 2 senior officers, a colonel and a captain, have acknowledged that they gave the order. Is that common understanding in Iraq? Is this news in Iraq?
Sadly, in many ways, it's not news in Iraq. People have, they're very jaded about the U.S. presence here on the one hand. But on the other hand, despite all of the atrocities that are committed and have been alleged and are being pursued in military courts, the atrocities committed by U.S. soldiers, there are numbers, a number of them. Despite those, many Iraqis still consider the U.S. troops more fair brokers than their Iraqi counterparts. And I think there's a certain element of jadedness about the U.S. troops, and that they've been saying this stuff. Maybe it's news to the U.S., but they've been saying this stuff for a long time, that the U.S. soldiers are abusing us, they're manhandling us, they're not being respectful of our culture and dignity and our homes. So it's news, it's noted on the Arab language channels, but it's not talking to anyone.
Can you talk about the piece you wrote for the Los Angeles Times, Barzu Dragi, about jihad, deaths at the door in Iraq, jihad being a place?
Well, this is a sort of a neighborhood in Baghdad that was a site of a really awful massacre on July 9th. And one of the things that, did quite a bit of reporting about what happened that morning exactly, and, traced the, tit-for-tat violence that preceded this morning. And eventually what happened and what appears to have happened was a quite a systematic, cold-blooded attack on the neighborhood in which Sunni Arab people, ordinary people, were systematically detained and killed, sometimes right on the street there. And then the case of some people who basically tried to stop this from happening, their homes burned down and, you know, basically turned into refugees as they were fleeing the situation there.
You also have written about the response in Iraq to what's happening in Lebanon. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's kind of funny in a way, but it's been the only, I guess, you know, Karl Rove or a political strategist would call it a bridge issue, you know, as opposed to a wedge issue. It's been the only unifying issue in Iraq. So, you know, even though you have different groups in Iraq killing each other and accusing each other of atrocities, everyone agrees that they are against Israel and they, you know, condemn Zionist aggression, so-called, and they come out very strongly in support of Lebanon, and many of them are coming out in support of the Hezbollah movement as well, and praising them as a defender of the Arab nation.
Borzu Dorogahi, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Borzu is in Baghdad. He's the bureau chief to the Los Angeles Times, and we will link to his articles at democracynow.org. As we turn now to our guest in studio, Yonatan Shapira. Demonstrations took place around the world this weekend calling for an end to Israel's attacks in Lebanon and Gaza. On Saturday, an estimated 10,000 protesters in Toronto marched from the Israeli consulate to the United States consulate. The protesters called for sanctions and a boycott of Israeli goods. Around 7,000 people joined a protest in London that took place along the Thames River. And several hundred took part in marches in Birmingham, Amsterdam, and downtown Chicago. Anti-war protests were also held in Israel. On Saturday in Tel Aviv, some 2,000 protesters held a demonstration against the war and the country's alliance with the United States. They also called on Israeli soldiers to refuse military service. Well, today we're joined in studio once again by Yonatan Shapira. He is a military refuser. Yonatan is a former captain in the Israeli Air Force Reserves in 2003. He initiated a group of Israeli Air Force pilots to sign a declaration refusing to participate in aerial attacks on the Palestinian territories. Yonatan is also a co-founder of the group Combatants for Peace. He was with us Friday, and we welcome him back to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. On Friday, we had a debate between you and the spokesperson for the Young Merits Peace Party in Israel around Lebanon. But I wanted to step back today to talk about how you arrived at the conclusions you did, for you, Yonatan, to talk about your personal story. Tell us how you became a soldier in Israel.
Okay. In Israel, it's quite obvious that if you are finishing your high school studies, you join the military. I was growing up in a family in military bases. My father was a squadron commander in the Yom Kippur War in 1973. My dream was to be a pilot. So for me, it was obvious that I will achieve this dream, and I will also contribute to the security of my country. In history lessons, I didn't learn about the occupation. I learned those beautiful peace and bereavement songs. I learned about the beautiful values about democracy, peace, justice, equality, freedom. And it took me many years to figure out and to know that at the same time that I was sitting in classroom, in school, learning all those beautiful values, my country, my military, was occupying and oppressing millions of Palestinians, millions of people that were living without all those beautiful values. We have so-called democracy for Jewish people or for Palestinians who are living within the 1967 border. But if you are living in the, if you live in the occupied territories, it's completely apartheid.
How did you come to this realization?
You know, it's a long, long process. And during this process, you suffer, you find out things that you do not want to believe. But if I have to point few events that really helped me to wake up and to connect all those threads to one understanding that I must say no publicly, not just going out and not participating in something, but also standing and shouting, we will not be part of it anymore. I can refer to two events that happened back in 2002. It was in the middle of the second Intifada, Al-Aqsa. The first event I was participating in, I flew Black Hawk helicopter and I was called, I was the first helicopter to come to a place which a terror attack took place, and many Jewish kids, many Israelis were injured severely, and I flew them with the Black Hawk to hospital in the center of Israel next to Tel Aviv, and all the helicopter was full of blood, and the paramedics and doctors tried to work on the patients, and while I was landing in the hospital, I saw underneath a wedding, and people were celebrating with the chuppah and the groom.
This was an Israeli wedding.
It was an Israeli wedding, and I was completely shocked. How can people be so much disconnected to reality?
And the kids, how had they been hurt?
They've been hurt severely by a Palestinian fighter who got in their house and shot all the family. And maybe I'll mention something that it's important. I am very much involved in the giving of support to terror victims in the Israeli side. I was volunteering in an organization named Sela, which is the Israeli Crisis and Management Center. I saw a lot of the suffering of my people. And what happened, few weeks later, after this event, when I brought these children to hospital, is that the commander of the Air Force and the government decided to assassinate the leader of the Hamas in Gaza Strip, Salah Shahadeh. And they ordered the F-16 with one-ton bomb that dropped this bomb on the house of the Hamas leader in Gaza Strip, killing with him 14 innocent civilians, 14 innocent people, including 9 babies. And although I didn't drop this bomb, and I didn't shoot my life, anyone, but I felt that this, me being part of this system that is causing this harm and this suffer and this killing to innocent people, it's just the same like being a terrorist in another organization. And those kids who were killed by my fellow pilots, and these kids that were killed by this Palestinian fighter, are just the same. And it took me a while to understand that not just these guys down in the wedding were disconnected to reality, but also in the cockpit here inside me was a lot of ignorance, a lot of things that I didn't know. And then you start to figure out and to learn and to find out all this half-side history lesson that you didn't get. And I realized that in order to change and not just to find a solution for myself, for my soul, for being able to live with myself, I have to do something publicly. And I went from one pilot to another, used my connection to the Israeli Air Force military by, people knew my father, and I lived in neighborhood with a lot of pilots. And I found more than 100 pilots that agreed to cooperate by being silent about that. Just few of them agreed to sign the petition that I wrote.
What do you mean, being silent?
It took us about 3 to 4 months to recruit all these co-signers on this letter. When you want to do something that will be strong enough, that will shake the Israeli public opinion and the government and the military, you want to find not just one or two pilots who are willing to refuse. So we found brigadier generals, colonels, Air Force squadron commanders, Apache pilots, F-16, F-15, Cobra, all kinds of squadrons from the Israeli Air Force, and all these guys agreed to keep silent while some of us are willing also to put their names on this petition and to refuse publicly. And as a result of this petition, there was a big uproar in Israel, and all the signers were called to an interview with the commander of the Air Force, General Chalutz, who is now the commander of the army, who is actually leading this criminally attacks on Lebanon. And in this interview with him, he told me that he's going to discharge me from being a pilot in the Air Force. And I told him that actually I'm willing to be charged by him. Don't just discharge me, but charge us all in charged of refusing to legal orders, because we are willing to sit in jail if they can show in court that these orders of killing suspects, and by that killing innocent civilians, is legal. And of course they prefer just to let us go, and no one of us was in prison. And since then, many of us became very active in the anti-occupation movement and in the anti-apartheid movement in Israel. And that's why I'm here today talking to the American people, talking to the Jewish community, trying to convince them that it's us who have to lead these demonstrations around the world. It's us Jewish people and Israelis and former fighters, former combatants that took part in these wars, to lead these demonstrations, who call for international pressure, who call for sanctions against the Israeli government, who is doing these cruel things in brutal things in Lebanon. It will harm us, Israelis. It will harm us, Jewish people, if we will not wake up now, because it will not continue forever. And someone have to put an end to this.
We're talking to Yonatan Shapira, former captain in the Israeli Air Force Reserves, initiated the group of Israeli Air Force pilots who refused to fly attack missions in Palestinian territories. We're going to go to break. When we come back, I want to ask you more about this one-hour meeting you had privately with the head of the Israeli army currently in Lebanon. And we're also going to bring on a Palestinian fighter, a former Palestinian fighter, who is in the group that you have co-founded, Combatants for Peace. He was in Israeli jail for some 7 years. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue our conversation with the Israeli soldier, the former captain in the Israeli Air Force Reserves, Yonatan Shapira. In 2003, he initiated the group of Israeli Air Force pilots who refused to fly attack missions on Palestinian territories. He also co-founded the group Combatants for Peace. In a minute, we're going to go to East Jerusalem to speak with a former Palestinian Fatah fighter who is in the group with Yonatan. But you mentioned this private meeting you had with General Chalutz. We see him on the news a lot now, talking about Lebanon.
What transpires? Just you and him?
Yeah, we were me and him in his commander's room. And he's a very charismatic person. Therefore, I think he's very dangerous. In that meeting, we discussed the whole issues and the situation in our country. I told him that I believe that these are war crimes and I do not want to participate in them. And I think that he should as well not participate and not order any people to go to participate in those missions. I told him also that I believe that if Israel decided to occupy Palestinians, Israel is responsible for the life of civilians. If Israel is responsible for the life, not just of the Israelis, but also the Palestinians. And then, in answering, he told me how he sees the different value of human beings. When Israeli citizens is on top, then Israeli soldiers, then Palestinian civilians, and then Palestinian fighters. And as a Jewish person, who is also from a family that suffered a lot in the Holocaust, and I was raised to be aware and to not to follow any kind of racist leaders, I think that now it's very important to be mentioned that these leaders, this guy, this specific commander is so dangerous for us. And Jewish people from all around the world must wake up and understand that in order to support Israel, in order to make sure that Israel will continue to exist, we must stop these guys. We must stop them because now they continue to lead soldiers. Young soldiers are being recruited today. And I saw just in the news how the commander, the same commander is recepting them and hugging them. And sometimes I feel that it's something like sacrificing some the Molech, some kind of worshiping. And in some way, if I can say just last thing about the Jewish community here in the United States, some people say that instead of worshiping God, the Jewish God, the Jewish community here, not all of them, but some of them, are worshiping Israel. And this is very dangerous.
You're talking about the Israeli Army Chief of Staff, Dan Chalutz. Yeah. What was his response to the issues you raised privately?
You know, he was sitting in front of me next to his desk. Under his hand was the newspaper from the last day and the pictures of all the Israelis, both Palestinians and Jewish, who died in a terror attack in Haifa. It was back in October 2003. And he told me that he is trying to protect these people from dying, and I'm just cooperating with the enemy. So I asked him if he can think, how come that this young lawyer, who was this suicide bomber in this attack, decided to sacrifice her life and to kill innocent people? How does he think that, you know, people, civilians, become suicide bombers? Don't you think that maybe we have to think, maybe we created this crazy jail while people don't have any other reason and they just don't have reason to live, so they become suicide bombers? And he said, you know what, I don't want to talk about this stuff. So what can I tell?
And the rationale of the Israeli government in Lebanon that Hezbollah has been raining down missiles in northern Israel, and that they have to protect the Israeli people and protect them for all time by routing out Hezbollah?
You know, it's insanity, and it's a lie, because my government now is refusing to cease fire. How can you, in one hand, cry about missiles that are attacking yourself, you, your family in Haifa and Afula and Kiryat Shmona, and at the same time refuse to cease fire? The same aspiration, the same idea that you can just kill and annihilate all the Hezbollah is the same logic of Nasrallah, that will kill all Israel or this kind of nonsense. And there is a lot of mental disorder issues here. And that's why I don't think that the solution for this situation will come from within the Israeli politics. That's why we have to work both from external pressure and internal pressure. The external pressure will be led by Israelis and Jewish people around the world with all the other human rights activists, and the internal pressure will be led by soldiers who refuse to participate in these war crimes.
I want to go to a fighter, a Palestinian fighter, who is with you in the group Combatants for Peace. Before we go to him in East Jerusalem, can you tell us about this group? Who's in it?
We decided that it's not enough just to say no. We have to find out what do we say yes to. And actually, my brother, who is also a refusnik, he was in the commando unit. He initiated this group with us and with several other Israeli refusers and Palestinian former fighters. We were all part of the violent struggle of our people, Israelis as well as Palestinians. And we decided a year and a half ago that we have to meet together and find a non-violent way to struggle against occupation and against this circle of mutual violence. And we find out that these guys have a lot in common with us. We were meeting for about a year in secret meetings, discussing our political views and our own process of transformation. And now, after our launching event in last April, we decided that we are ready to go all over the world, in Israel, in Palestine, but all over the world, to bring our message to the people.
Yonatan Shapira, let's turn now to Bassam Aramin, former member of Fatah, served a prison sentence of 7 years. Arrested in Hebron when he was 17 years old, speaking to us from East Jerusalem. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bassam Aramin.
Thank you.
Can you talk about how you came to be in Combatants for Peace? You were in Fatah, you were a fighter in the first Intifada?
Yes, I was a fighter before the first Intifada. As you mentioned, from Fatah movement, and recently I involved in the new group with Israelis, Combatants for Peace, which is composed from both sides, and it's open for anyone who looks for peace and settlement for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We have the main principles of our group, our courage and moral group. First of all, to put an end for the Israeli military occupation to the West Bank and Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, to be free from settlers and soldiers and walls and checkpoints, to replacement of killing and bloodshed by peace and reconciliation between the two peoples, to implementation of the two-state solution, living side by side in full cooperation and peace. And we have an important message in this group. We want to say to the Israelis and to the Palestinians and to all the world that we have a partner. We are partners, and the Israeli government must stop saying that there are no partners, there are nobody to speak or to negotiate with in the Palestinian side.
What is the response of other fighters and former fighters to you? For example, the people you served time in prison with. You served from 1985 to 1992. You were a leader in the Israeli jail?
And me?
What is the response of other fighters, people who, and former fighters in Fatah, in Hamas, to what you are doing? Calling for a non-violent solution.
Yes, we have a big group. Almost we have 100 at least Palestinians, ex-fighters and ex-prisoners who believe in this this new way, and they are very courage. And I want to thank them. Also, I want to thank the Israeli ex-combatants or soldiers for their moral and courage stand to refuse to be apart from the part of Palestinian suffering, or to refuse to be apart from the of the occupation.
Can you describe, Yonatan, your first meeting with Bassam?
Yeah,
I'm asking Yonatan to describe his first meeting with you.
We were a small group. It was the beginning when we started to initiate this group. And we decided that each meeting, we will start by one or two people from each side will tell their own story. So we will start to create these bonds, this connection to each other. And it was very strong to hear what Bassam has to say and what Suleiman, another guy there, has to say. And for them to listen to Israeli soldiers telling about, for example, one guy in our group was the commander of the Kalandia checkpoint, which is a horrible place where thousands of Palestinians are standing every day and being humiliated. And to see suddenly the commander of this checkpoint sitting with them as a refuser, as a refusnik, saying that he is going to work with them hand by hand, side by side, to put an end to this crazy situation was something very, very exciting and encouraging. I just want to mention, I know that we don't have too much time, in October, an organization that was established by a faculty called the Faculty for Israeli-Palestinian Peace, FFIPP, is going to bring Bassam and me to the States to a big national tour in campuses, giving lectures and meeting students and meeting media and everyone that wants to listen to the message that we have to say. If people are interested to having us in their campuses, they can contact this organization, FFIPP.
And I will link at Democracy Now! We'll link to that organization, and people could go to our website at democracynow.org.
If I can mention last thing, if we still have 1 minute, there is the issue of normalization. And many Palestinians are afraid that when you create a dialogue group, you also have some kind of accepting the occupation, accepting the oppressor. But this group is different. Once you are creating a coexistent group, a group of people who are reconciling with each other, but also are extremely connected to the political call and to the political action, I think it's right and it has a right to exist now. We are not just solving our own problems and curing our own wounds. We also call for massive pressure against the Israeli government that continue this occupation, and this must be mentioned.
Do you see that pressure building in the United States as an Israeli who's been spending time here?
You know, it's one of the hardest things because there is so much ignorance here, and seeing what your government is doing in Iraq and Afghanistan and all over the world, you don't have so much hope. But sometime you must do something in order to still have a reason to live and to wish in this world. And I also believe that if we can put some pressure on European leaders that are a bit less ignorant than your government, maybe we can make something.
We have to leave it there. Yonatan Shapira, former captain in the Israeli Army Force Reserve, also joining us from East Jerusalem. Bassam Aramin, former member of Fatah, served in an Israeli jail for 7 years, arrested when he was 17 years old. And that does it for our broadcast. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mark Burke, Sharif Abdokadush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuba Rich, Aaron Mate, and Frank Lopez. Mike DiFilippo, Nick Marsilio are our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.